Okay, number six, the California Virtual Academy at Los Angeles High School, Memorandum of Understanding.
Yes, okay. I guess I'm going to have Ellie Valentine start this. It has to do with the CAVA actually opening up a secondary program and producing another contract for us with the secondary program.
As you know, West Covina currently authorizes two charters for California Virtual Academies. One that we've had for a number of years is a K-12 program. The newest CAVA was authorized last summer, and it's CAVA LA High School, serving the students in grades 9 through 12. There were some delays in their start date, but they are up and running. A handful of students have started in CAVA LA High School. They continue to operate the K-12 program and serve 9th through 12th grade students there. It is the intent that as the high school program develops, all of the 9th grade or all of the high school students move to the high school program, and then in a reauthorization, they'll have operate a K-8 program. This MOU mirrors the current MOU that serves K-12. There provides for 3% oversight. There is no supporting of or buying of services from CAVA by the school district. I think that's about all. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer them.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Shoemaker, do you have any questions? Mr. Cox, Ms. Poulos.
I think it reflects everything we discussed, and I think it's very fair.
Mr. Spence.
I'll move it.
Okay.
Actually, Ms. Valentine and I actually went over and visited their community day school today, and it was very interesting to see how they bring the kids together and instruct them one day a week. So it's a nice visitation.
Good. And thank you. Ms. Shoemaker is seconding it. Okay, so it was moved by Mr. Spence and seconded by Ms. Shoemaker to approve the Memorandum of Understanding between the district and the California Virtual Academy at Los Angeles. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion is carried 5-0. Number seven, information report. State and federal programs. I will turn this over to Ms. Kaplan.
This is kind of the time of year that we look at our state and federal program grants and revisit how we allocate the funds, with the goal being trying to allocate as much money as we can to our schools. There was some flexibility to do it. So we'd like to present for you tonight what our recommendation is for the 2012-13 year.
Okay. This is updated from your packet.
Yes, this packet is updated. I just want to say, by getting our reports to you on Thursday, we put draft on all of them, so you get the gist of what we're going to be reporting, but we need to revise it.
Yes. Then you change it. That's how you're going to get us.
Well, sometimes I need the...
Nothing major.
Nothing major.
That's how you're
going to
get us.
I know you said it was a draft, but it doesn't say draft on here.
You know what, it says draft on, we'll start putting it on here, we put it on the...
Oh, right, no, on your transmittal it did, but it then...
Yeah,
it
didn't
on the... It could get mixed
you're right.
up.
I think at the very bottom, in the little footer,
no, it does.
It's very small, I couldn't...
I can see it
I
now.
Tried to make it bigger, but...
Now that you said it.
Okay, it's there. I know that is confusing. Good evening.
Good evening.
I'd like to share with you a little bit of overview, some of this. You already know it's not new, but then eventually get to our proposal. Okay, let's make it go. Okay. Tonight I'll be talking roughly about our federal and state grants for supplemental services to students. Title I Part A is a federal grant, brings about $1.2 million to the district. Title II, it provides for professional development, another federal grant, We are estimating that it's going to be at about $279,000. That's greatly reduced over the past few years, but we don't exactly know what it is for this year. We're assuming it's going to be the next year. Title III provides supplemental services for English learners of about $130,000. That's federal dollars also. And then in state funds, we have EIA, or State Comp Ed, SCE, State Compensatory Education, about $800,000. And LSLIP, the Library and School Improvement Grant, at about $730,000, we're estimating. I do want to say that these are all assumptions based on a state budget that we don't have. Our federal dollars have not yet been finalized for 2012, so we are sort of estimating those as well as for next year. We do serve the students in our own district for federal programs. Additionally, we serve private schools that are nonprofit that are in our LEA area. We'd like to point out that currently EIA mandates include that we spend at least 75% of those dollars on English learners, but there is a bit of flexibility that allows up to 25% to be used for other purposes or state comp ed. In our current state budget proposal, one of the proposed items is that EIA become fully flexible as other programs have in the past few years. Eligibility for these programs is determined by a number of things. For Title I, it is socioeconomically disadvantaged students determine eligibility. For Title III, it's English learner, and we determine that using the CELT. For EIA and State Comp Ed, sort of those two federal models are used at a state level. So for EIA, we'd use CELT, and for State Comp Ed, we would use the socioeconomically disadvantaged count. Library and School Improvement Program is a bit different. It is supplemental to support supplemental services and program and overall school improvement. But it doesn't have an eligibility. The Title I school eligibility is mandated. So students who are attending schools with a socioeconomically disadvantaged rate at or the district average must receive funds. If we have any schools, which we don't, over 75%, those must be funded. Students who attend schools where the rate is less than 35% are not funded. But there is an optional area between the 35% and the state average, which may be funded, and traditionally West Covina has funded those schools. We do that through an exception, or that's through the state waiver process that is generally built into our CONAP. Though there is a requirement that we fund those schools, there is some federal flexibility in what resource we use to fund all of our schools. And so later as I talk in the presentation, I'll talk about the possibility of exercising some of that flexibility. There are two formulas that we constantly work with. That's a state Title I formula and the district formula. The state determines distribution of state Title I funds to the individual LEAs based on a rather complicated formula of a census poverty count for youth in a certain age range in a geographical area that is our LEA. And then once those funds come to the LEA, we determine that we will distribute those based on our socioeconomically disadvantaged count. So that's sort of the method that we use. Sometimes this is confusing because we think that participation in the federal free lunch program generates these dollars. That's not the mechanism for generating the dollar. And then once we accept Title I program dollars, we are required, of course, to run that program. And so that requires a comprehensive LEA plan. And then at the school level, of course, they do their school plan, and those plans are built around two delivery models. One's called targeted assistance, where plans are individualized to each of the students who is eligible, or a school-wide program plan, which allows for more flexibility in the program and to provide services for all students at the school. Over the past several years, all of our schools have moved to a school-wide plan. At the district level, we have, in addition to the comprehensive plan, we have some program mandates, and they include reservations of some of those funds for administrative costs that include the indirect cost. For parent involvement, we must reserve 1% at both the district level and at each site level, and each site must include a program of parent involvement, so parent education is usually the most frequently part of parent involvement. We must include services to homeless youth. Professional development is key to all Title I and really all federal plans, and provide for assistance to schools. It's our responsibility at the district level to support all of our schools in being achieving schools. Additionally, under NCLB, the accountability model included sanctions for school identified as program improvement. And since we are still sort of operating under NCLB, since we don't have a reauthorization, those still include, if you were in year one of program improvement, set asides for professional development both at the district and school site level, the option for parents to use choice transportation at the district expense, and then going into year two, program improvement, it would be all of those things above, plus the supplemental education service. So outside vendors could be providing services, direct services to our students at our expense. This year, California Elementary, as you know, is in year one of program improvement. It's likely with the targets moving up that they could progress into year two program improvement, so we would have some additional reservations. Also, we're watching carefully three of our elementary schools who are at risk of entering program improvement based on 2012 data. So as we test in the next few months, it will be that data that will be used. Those are Vine, Cameron, and Orangewood. As these targets, or the AMOs for language arts and math, increase, I think the likelihood that our schools and many schools really across the state will be identified. As we plan our district program of services, we look primarily at two things because these really come to the heart of Title I, our compensatory programs. One is student achievement, and the other is low income, or the percent of socioeconomically disadvantaged students. The program initial design continues to be the design is to provide supplemental services to low-income and low-achieving students. So depending on those two factors, one is demographic and one is student accountability achievement, depending on those two factors, the program needs and program model may change to respond to those. As I said, it's our responsibility to plan and implement a program based on the analysis of district level and school level achievement data. So when we talk about either the LEA or sites going into program improvement or not, or where our areas of attention really have to be focused. This is what we're doing. We use our data to do that. And then we determine what grade spans are best served by our supplemental dollars. And then, of course, once we do that, we have to monitor those schools and programs on a regular basis. Those things can change even midway during an authorization, as the state accountability notebook is modified sometimes between the state and the federal government. Right now, things are sort of static, and I think that is in part because we keep waiting for the reauthorization. Our current funding model includes district-level reservations that reflect that we have one school in program improvement. It is a site-level allocations are based on a formula that's based upon our K-12 socioeconomically disadvantaged count. That's about 6,100 students. And that establishes the base allocation for our elementary school. We have focused our efforts on our elementary schools following the research that indicates the earliest possible intervention is the best. So the earlier we intervene, kids seem to recover and do best. Then dollars that would have gone to the 9-12 count, or that's about 1,800 students in our case, those are redistributed as a supplemental allocation to the schools in the districts that are above the district average. Our district average, we're estimating for next year at 61%. And then we have been, for the last few years, making an allocation of state-level SIP and EIA funds to our middle and high schools for compensatory services and to develop program. So as we start preparing for next year, we were looking at our CBEDS results. And this year, as we pull those up, we note that Merced actually has dropped a little bit overall in SED count. And a couple of our schools have sort of remained about the same. So the ranking looks a little bit different this year. And the main thing is that Merced is now under the district average of socioeconomically disadvantaged. And I think Orangewood count is actually down a little bit. When we put that on a chart that sort of explains all this, I think a little bit easier. This is what it looks like. And this is looking at our K-8 schools, so elementary and middle intermediate schools. When we rank our schools, you see the 8 at the top, sort of above that green line, as schools above the district average. So those are schools that we must fund. We have no schools below that red line, which is the 35%. Okay. The schools in the middle are the 4 schools that we have the option to fund. In our case, the distance between the schools above and the distance below is not significant, between 61% and 59%. Clearly, we have students who need services and would benefit from supplemental services. So that would be in that permissive zone. When we look through the other lens, at student achievement with this same group of schools, we noticed that, and this is due actually to some of the really great growth our elementary schools made last year, that our middle schools are among the lower performing school. We now have all of our elementary sites above 800, well above 800. Last year, 4 of our sites made exceptional growth. And what this did, though our middle schools made growth, it widened a gap between the achievement of our elementary schools and our middle schools, indicating to us that there are real concerns about the lower achievement of our middle school students versus elementary students. And sort of if we apply that original intent of compensatory programs, it's to serve lower achieving, low economic students first. That should be our priority. That's where we want to focus. So with that, we're recommending a change in program for next year. I do want to say that though I'm making a recommendation for next year, I don't know if this recommendation would go beyond that, simply because there are many unknowns. We don't have a current state budget. We don't know what our state budget will be looking like a year out. And we continue to wait sort of year after year for a reauthorization of ESEA. But I am recommending that we change the model to include our focus on both elementary and middle grade span schools. And within that, we have two additional options. One includes just a straight Title I distribution, but the other one includes an option B to really leverage funds from our federal programs and our state programs to maximize the amount of funds we distribute out to our school sites. So what I'm suggesting in option A is that we continue to fund California, likely a program improvement year two school with Title I. But in doing that, we have to make some additional reservations, which then limits the dollars we would distribute to all of our other schools. In option B, we would use a federal option to skip California in Title I funds. The rule says that you don't have to use Title I funds to fund the school, but you have to use an equal amount of some other sort of funding. So we can't skip them altogether. We just have the option of what fund we want to use. So in doing that, I also recommend that we use state compensatory education funds to provide that same level of support to California. I believe that we can use library SIP funds to augment the K through 8 schools to keep overall funding at a level very close to what it is this current year. And continue to fund our 9-12 sites to develop, program, maintain district supports at or near, again, the same level that we have this year. So what does that look like? I think sometimes it's easier to look when you're looking at a chart. In column A, up on the board, would be taking Title I only, distributing to our K-8 sites, and that also includes making the reservations based on the year two sanctions. And if you see what happens for some of our schools, it goes down. Okay, and so of course when we did this, we weren't happy with that because it actually reduces the amount of dollars to schools. But remember, we're distributing to additional schools, and it's additional funding because we have to make a greater set aside for year two program improvement. At that point, we started looking at some additional options. So in option B, you see that Title I and or state compensatory education funds would be used for our schools. So you see at the top, California would be funded there with state compensatory education. Then you see the funding amounts, and this is, again, assumption based upon current enrollment and SED count. And then we would use either state comp ed or school improvement dollars to augment that to bring it up to a level near 11-12. I do also want to make clear that the figure in the column that says 11-12 preliminary, That was our preliminary allocation to schools. An additional allocation is being made actually right now. We keep waiting for the state to make a final allocation so we know where we are. We don't have that. But we've gone through our budgets, and we believe there is enough leeway for us to make a bit of an additional allocation to our schools. So it's actually higher than that. What this does is a couple of things. In a sense, it creates a structural in terms of how we structure the program, remedy to California that's in program improvement. It doesn't limit necessarily how much funding California is getting, but what it does take off the board is our need to do a reservation that I estimate at nearly $200,000 for services for California students. Now, I don't know that we would spend all of that, but we have to make that reservation. That takes those funds out of the distribution pool. So in addition, I mean, essentially what we're saying is by putting $80,000 to $90,000 into California, it releases about $200,000 to distribution to our other schools. At the high school, this has mostly been about our elementary sites, but at the high school program, we believe that we can continue to support that program well with LSIP. LSIP is a broader program designed for overall school improvement. It does provide supplemental services, but it also provides dollars, and the intent of that is to just overall school improvement program. It's broader. I think it matches better to the high school program. The numbers there, again, are proposed and very preliminary based on just rough projections. We do project that Edgewood High School will grow, so, of course, their allocation would go up based on enrollment. We're sort of predicting that West Covina High School will go down, but I'm not confident that will happen. Mm-hmm. It hasn't happened. It's sort of stayed the same. And Coronado is right about 200 students right now. The data for the 912 schools is a little bit different. I think you all understand the accountability model for West Covina High School. However, Edgewood doesn't have any big set of data yet. It was only this year they took the CASE, so we don't have ELA and math results for that. Their API was only based on their ninth grade last year. So it will be a fuller group of students this year. And Coronado participates in the ASAM model, so it's a little bit different model of accountability, so it's not exactly one that can be matched. So what is the impact of this? We're doing a number of things. But I think first of all, most important, it serves the students based on analysis of the school needs and assessment results. It maintains our site funding at a level comparable to what they're getting this year. It does distribute some of our EIA allocation as state comp ed. We do believe that we can adequately do this. We are providing a good level of service and support to our English learner through both EIA and ELAP. So we've looked through those budgets carefully, and we do believe we can do both within that budget. It does have some impact on the NCLB accountability, though it might avoid the year two sanctions for California. A year from now, our middle schools will be fully under that current accountability model. If ESEA is reauthorized, it could look very different. We don't know what that's going to look like. So as I make this recommendation, I also feel that it's important that we look at this really on a year-by-year basis because we have many variables, not only the variables of our schools and student achievement in terms of demographics, but we have many state variables in terms of our budget, and at the federal level in terms of reauthorization of the ESEA. So if you have questions, and I'm sure you do, I'll be happy to answer those.
Okay. Thank you so much for your presentation, Ms. Valentine. Ms. Poulos, do you have any questions?
Let me go later.
Ms. Shoemaker. Mr. Cox. Mr. Spence.
Let me go later. I'll start. Thank you for presenting this and not telling me everything's equal. Appreciate that. That solves a lot of problems right off the top. I did have a question on if we were to adopt. I guess I don't know if are you recommending one? Are you going to recommend one at some point? Or
we are recommending. We wanted to present
this
with
B?
You tonight.
Is
to get
the one
some
recommending?
Feedback. We're recommending B.
Okay.
But we wanted an opportunity to get feedback from you.
What does it look like if we were to only take 10% out for administrative costs and put that money back into the classroom services? Does that bring us anything?
We don't go up to the total 15% right now. I don't know exactly where we are right now. I would have to go back and look. It depends. Our indirect cost changes every year. I get that from, you know, business services. So I'll have to figure out what that is and then what our other administrative costs are. But I certainly could get that information for you.
I mean, you know, because, you know, we talk about if we're going to have to do cuts and do things, you know, to keep it out of the classroom. And when you look at some of the numbers here, you know, I'm not sure what the cuts actually mean as far as services, mm-hmm. you know. And that, I guess that's a question that I have is, you know, what are we actually losing for, $8,000 somewhere? You know what I mean? What are we losing for that? What is a school gaining with, like, an increase? You know, and I guess, you know, rather than just looking at dollars and saying da-da-da-da, you know, what are we losing? And would supplementing that by reducing our administrative overhead costs, taking out of that student money, would that get us back to what we were going to lose?
I don't think so. I could work those.
Well, what are we losing then? I mean, why not?
Can I get clarification on administrative costs? My understanding is that basically goes back to the general fund and supports the work that goes into producing these grants?
To some degree. The indirect is the part that comes off from business services to
right.
do the business services. There's a part of the law that says the law can't mandate us to do something unless there are funds provided to do that. So then of the other administrative cost, it covers a portion of the staff who manages that program.
Oh, and all the other attendant costs to it as well. Right? It's not just staff. It's other administrative costs as well.
Ms. Bastin, can you explain that?
Right. Is it?
Between the indirect and the administrative together cannot exceed the 15%.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what would it be like if we did 10?
I don't know. I'd have to go back and...
And I mean, I guess,
okay.
And does that make
well,
a difference in something, the service we're going to lose? That's what I want to know is like, okay, what service are we going to lose? And then, you know, what service are we going to lose over a few thousand dollars that's really valuable, or are we losing nothing, you know, and it's not a big deal? I mean, that to me is what I want to know when I look at these numbers, you know, because that's what I'm having the hard time quantifying. I mean, it's easy to go, okay, look, okay, we're down this, but we're up this, we're down that. But, you know, well, what does that mean? What does it mean as far as the service? What are we losing?
I just want to respond to two things. I think with the administrative cost, you know, it really is robbing Peter to pay Paul because that's coming off the top. But it's let's say we said we're going to do no administrative costs, then there would be more money coming off the general fund for these administrative costs as opposed to the restricted funds.
Well, I didn't. Who said that?
That's my understanding.
Who said we were going to fund them? I didn't say that we were going to.
Well, it's a portion of people. It's a portion.
I didn't say we were going to keep administrative costs exactly the same.
What I'm trying to explain the concept. I understand what you're saying. But in terms of the funds itself, we give a budget to the schools based on the formula, and
right.
then they go to their school site councils and determine
well.
How they're going to spend those funds. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't tell, until we sit down with each school and say these are the funds that are being directed towards you, what we were trying to do is leverage the funds so we could give the most amount of money to the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that was
right.
the purpose for this recommendation.
I understand that. And that's fine with me. I don't have a problem with that. I'm just trying to figure out, now, what service does that mean we're losing if we're reducing the amount? I mean, what is it that we're losing?
That would be, I'd have to have each principal come up here and talk to you about what that means
to their
school.
I mean, because to me, you know, that's more valuable for me to know than just we're losing $8,000, $9,000, $20,000, whatever the number is. And, you know, and so then the question comes, well, if we're losing something very valuable over a little bit of money, then could we reduce our indirect costs and, you know, fund a student program that we find valuable?
And I guess I'd have to ask Ms. Bastin to do an analysis of what that would mean.
Well, I don't know if she can do it until we tell her, until we know what the services are that we're going to lose because of it.
And we can't pay the services we're going to lose until we bring the principals here to talk about their budget.
Well, it's not completely true because there's people, if there are people providing the services, we have to lay them off, you know, so at, during certain times and certain things. And so, you know, we have to have some kind of idea of what the program is, I would hope, right?
Well, I think it's one of those cases where you have to work on both program and budget at the same time. Our schools really can't plan their budget unless they sort of know what the parameter is going to be. Though they can work on some elements that I know that all schools will do. They'll all include professional development. They'll all improve supplemental instruction for their students. The degree to which they might do that could change based on funding amounts. You know, if I have, you know, funds for 3 days of professional development consultant and not the fourth, then maybe that's what it would be. I think those things we sort of work on simultaneously. We know we want to have a good program, but it has to be fiscally responsible too.
Well, of course, and I'm not advocating otherwise. I'm just saying then what's the purpose of coming up with a model that tries to keep us at the same level of last year's funding? I mean, there has to be programs that we're funding right now and that we want to keep, or we wouldn't be trying to get the money up to that level,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
I think
so what do we lose then of those ongoing programs that we have, you know, because of a shift of dollars?
So you want to know what we are currently funding out of these programs?
Well, what we lose with losing money. And if we're going to lose something that we find valuable for a few thousand bucks, then that doesn't make any sense to me. But if it's something that, it's no big deal, you know, it doesn't have an impact, then that's fine. You know, and so, you know, I guess that's what I'm looking for, to try to quantify, you know, because, you know, we could do the bean counter stuff on, oh, this and that, you know, and, you know, this and that, and then we're finally there, that's fine. But, you know, what service are we losing,
mm-hmm.
you know? And is it something valuable that's only a few thousand bucks? Then we can change how we do our indirect costs and find savings away from the classroom to do it. That's what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
So what are you asking us to bring to you so you have
a
better understanding?
Well, I assume, again, and it sounded like this is the case, that we want to do B because that gets California, rather than a, $40,000, $35,000, $36,000 cut, they only have an $11,000 cut.
No, they wouldn't have a cut.
Oh, because of the augmentation?
Yes, yes.
Okay, they wouldn't have a cut because of the augmentation, right.
So if you look at the augmentation, nobody... We're trying to keep it at the same level this year.
Yeah, right, okay. And but some of them are going to go up radically, too.
Yes.
Okay, so what's EMS going to do with that money?
Well, they would have to develop their program. I do want to say that the EMS and Walnut Grove numbers look a little bit skewed. This was discretionary funds. In the past, we had provided a staff position. For example, when we had the eight-period day, the same funding source funded that. So they had it in service versus discretionary dollars. With the loss of the eight-period day, that sort of changed mm-hmm. things. And as I said, these were our preliminary allocations.
Right, and actually, so they might be taking a cut then.
No, I don't think they'll take a cut. I mean, that was...
No, if you're adding... Okay, well...
Concerned.
Well, if you add 91,000 and you're adding to that number, and the one's 91,000 now... then isn't that less than if you're augmenting it? For example, in California, right? If you combine those two on B,
yes.
right, that comes to about what the preliminary number was. But you said there's another allocation going on right now.
And these, as I said, these are all preliminary. I want to be cautious because we don't yet have our Title I final figure for this year. So, again, we're, you know, I'm trying to be cautious, but at least give... a good estimate so we can plan for next year. I think this is rather extraordinary that we're in March. We don't have a final number for our 11-12 year. We're still working on preliminary numbers, yet we're in a position of having to prepare for next year and to give figures to our school sites so they can develop their plan.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is that if those figures are going to be down from what, you know, they're spending now, and there's some kind of program or cut that's taking place, you know, I want to know what service we're losing and if it's valuable or not for the amount of money that's being cut.
There's two questions out here right now. We recommended this model because in this model we're able to include more money to our two middle schools who have the highest SES, SED, and need more for achievement. So the reason we're recommending this model is we don't have to put $200,000 in reservation, and we're able to fund our two middle schools at a much higher level and keep everyone else equal. So that's the concept, the philosophy behind this. What I hear you asking, if we take a look at our administrative costs and determine that we're not going to take X percent, there'll be more money, and how would we distribute that money? Because
that's what I'm saying.
Well, right now we're looking at minimal cuts. We're looking at very minimal cuts to try to keep everything equal to what it was last year and support our middle schools. We're trying to give more dollars to our schools.
Right.
So I'm not clear what you want us to bring to you next week so you can better understand.
Next week?
The next meeting.
Next week? Well, I'm going based on the fact that you're doing another allocation now, right, to this amount on the 11-12 here. And so that amount's going to go up. And so if we're telling school sites we're going to budget that they're currently getting, like, theoretically $100,000, let's say, from whatever California, right? But for purposes of planning, they get $90,000, right, based on the B model that we're approving now?
Well, right? This is 11-12. This was preliminary last year, this current.
Right, and you said there's a supplemental allocation going on right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So explain that. Because you have to put money reservations away, and if you don't spend those reservations at this point in time, you redistribute them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if we went with number A and we put $200,000 in reservation, which we have to do for California, at the end of the year, if we didn't spend it, we would be redistributing it. It's part of there's certain money you have to put away you can't spend. You're supposed to spend on other things, and if you don't, you redistribute it.
Right, but that tells me
that we're getting more money.
I understand we're not getting more money, but money is going to school sites. More money is going to school sites.
Right.
Right? Okay. So they're spending $100,000 at that school site, let's say, with the supplemental, theoretically. And we're telling them to plan on spending 91. I want to know what we're losing for the $9,000. And is that something big? Is it something that doesn't matter? And then if it doesn't matter, okay. You know, when we look at everything, if it does matter and it's something important, I'm saying we can change the formula on how we do the indirect costs so that the district office gets less money. And I'm not saying take that from another fund. I'm saying less money. Uh-huh. And
still be recommending B. We would just be saying look at the administrative costs. The decision is what we want to do with administrative costs, whether we're doing A, B, C, or D. So we're trying to get a direction in terms of which one of these make more sense. The next question is, do we add more money to this pot through administrative costs? I'm confused. That's how I'm hearing it.
Okay. I'm fine with B.
Okay.
If that makes everybody feel happy.
Okay.
Is that happy? Happy time?
That's step one.
Step two is, if we're going to tell a school to plan on less money, what are they getting rid of? Because we're telling them to plan on less money, and then is there a way to change what we charge off on the indirect costs that we can get them the money for the service? That's what I want to know. Does that make sense now?
And I think so.
Okay.
Did I say the happy thing, though, about I support B?
But I think I can clarify. Every year, schools work with a preliminary budget and then a final budget. This is a rather unique year that we have no clue about the final budget until late. So usually, we would make an additional allocation, and then schools would sort of know about that usually, by the end of January. But we would sort of know it ahead of time, and we could tell them what to plan for, and then we could say, okay. I think the things that our schools probably have been very cautious about, well, for one thing, our schools sort of traditionally were carrying quite a bit of carryover. I would say between 5 and 10%. They're not carrying any now. They're right down to the wire. The other thing I think that schools have been very cautious about is their spending for supplemental instruction, so before school or after school instruction with small groups of students. They're still doing that. We've used other funding sources to help with that, but I think they're being very, very cautious how they use that.
Mm-hmm.
And really down to every penny. They call back and they ask,
right. Even more of a reason to say, okay, what are we going to lose if we cut this amount from it? That's what I want to know. I just want to know what we're going to lose. And then we can make a decision if we think, maxing out as on the indirect costs and administrative costs is worthwhile or not.
Well, if we
no offense to anyone in the district office or who gets a little piece of that.
I don't think we're maxing out, but I'll make sure.
Well, I think that what we need to do is if we agree to go with B, then we can have them start their budgets and we can ask that question. And at the same time, we can bring back the information as where does the administrative cost go so that you have that information in terms of if it's 10% or 50%, what is it being used for? I think that would be helpful to know as well.
Thank you. You had called on Ms. Bastin, and she was ready to respond because she – no, you're okay? Okay, because – okay, because it sounded like there was something to add there. Thank you. Ms. Shoemaker has something to add or question.
The 11-12 preliminary that we're seeing here does not have the additional allocation.
Is correct.
This is the number that the schools used to budget last year.
It's a planning number, yes.
And so the numbers in B basically match up to the numbers
right, they're
in
preliminary.
11-12.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's where the difficulty in your question is, because they planned California planned last year using 91,000. They're now going to get an additional allocation that they weren't expecting. They planned based on getting 91,000.
Right.
Yeah, they're getting an additional allocation. So they spent it on something.
And they're going to get that same
when they did their plan.
No, they're not going to get it.
They planned on only getting 91,000. They are being told for next year to plan on getting 91,000.
Right.
So
you're
asking them to sort of explain what they're cutting, but at this point they're basically getting the same amount of money throughout the year.
Right.
So
I think that's why
it's hard for them to look at what the cut is, because they're adding additional money
but then
that
they're
didn't
cutting
expect.
Next year, right?
No, not necessarily, because it would be preliminary again.
It's like us.
Yeah,
we start
you're
with
assuming
the
you're getting it, right? So why can't we start with a higher preliminary number by changing the indirect costs and getting more money into the programs?
Well,
can't we look at what the
it's already is? Significantly more, isn't it? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Some of them, but yeah.
But you're also making the assumption, and I may have misheard, but we budget that 15% is an administrative cost. That is not necessarily what is being spent at this moment in administrative
right.
costs.
Right.
Well, then
I don't think
spending?
We've ever
well,
gone
that's
to
and let's
that.
Let's put the other 2% back in right now so they can
that's
plan for it.
Well,
the
other
2% we'll get that for the next
that we don't
meeting.
Spend in administrative costs does go back.
Yes. Goes
yes.
back to the bottom
anything,
line.
Let's have a plan for
right.
it.
Right. In any single year, any dollars that are carryover at the district level are automatically redistributed to all of our sites.
And
so
the 15%. Though.
Right, there is no carryover at the district level. School sites are allowed to keep some of their carryover if it's under, I think it's under 10%. But as I said, our school sites are not they used to carry over.
Right.
So
it tells me that they're getting close to
yeah.
And the stuff they're adding is last minute stuff. Is it last minute stuff they're adding if they only planned on it?
No, but I think, they plan just as we all do. You have your priorities. I think what things that perhaps are not perhaps, and this is just, sort of a random example. Say that you want to add some additional supplemental books for your library to enhance your library collection. Okay, a principal might put that they're going to spend $5,000 on that. Maybe they really wanted to spend 10, but they know that they have a limit, so they budget for 5. When additional dollars comes in, that might be among the things on the list. Okay, now I can get this next set of books to enhance the library collection. So that would be an example.
Yeah, I mean, that's one example. But wouldn't it make more sense then, if they're going to get the money, to have them plan it out so it's planned? And we can do that using the indirect costs? I mean, you're making an argument that they add stuff at the end because they think they might get it. Well, that, you know, well, let's let them plan on having it then.
Well, certainly, I don't think our indirect cost or administrative services should be more than we need to run the program. And,
okay.
I'll check on that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to know the number. But I'm just saying, why not let them plan from the beginning to use this money rather than at the very end of the school year?
Well, I suppose it's possible at the very end of the school year like we are now, and we still don't have a final number.
Mm-hmm.
We're sort of working without a real number there.
I find it a little nervous.
Well, the fake number is what they're showing you, and it's being conservative rather than spending more than what we necessarily think is coming
in.
But
if we traditionally only spend 11% or 12% of our indirect and stuff, why not let the sites plan how they're going to spend that 3% now?
Because the 3% may change if our indirect costs go up.
Well,
indirect costs
can go up or down based on whatever formula the district says.
I think this conversation really needs to be looking at the actual cost and the actual numbers.
I'm going to look at the service and whether or not it's valuable.
Yeah. Okay, then thank you. We'll get it for the next meeting. Yes, Ms. Poulos.
Okay. The program improvement status sanctions, if it sounds like California did not use all
Correct.
Of their money set aside. Does that money redistribute
right.
to all the
uh-huh.
schools or just to California and they can use it in another way?
No, we set it aside at the LEA level. And then, for example, this year was for transportation. So when we knew that we weren't going to have to spend any of that money for transportation, then we certainly went through all of our budgets again. And normally we would make this redistribution once we get the final number from the state. We're just not getting the final number from the state. So I directed staff, you know, we just need to go ahead, distribute this out to the sites, and when the state number comes in, reevaluate where we are at that point. And it's possible they could, you know, get a little bit more at that point.
You said you put it aside for choice transportation. What about supplemental educational services?
We did not have to offer that this year.
Because it was
year
one.
Mm-hmm. And for us, that would be, you know, that potentially would be a more expensive sanction. Our district is geographically small, and we don't have a lot of people asking to go to different schools, so there isn't, you know, the liability for as much cost.
But the supplemental educational services, I thought that would be like Sylvan or, you know, like somebody we vendored
right.
with that they would go to.
Right, but the parents have the choice. And
right,
so
right.
any of those providers advertise at the school, advertise to the parents can select, and we have to establish contracts with all of those up to their limit.
And then, once again, if that money wasn't used, it would be set aside at the district level and then redistributed mm-hmm. to all of the schools.
Yes.
They didn't have to be in program improvement
Correct.
Status to get any of that
Correct.
Money. And then how much more money, if Vine, Cameron, and Orangewood would all be in year one and California would be in year two, how much more would we have to set aside?
We'd still have to do the district-wide set-aside for professional development, and that would sort of cover. Each of those sites would have to do an individual set-aside for professional development.
Okay.
And then we would have the choice and the supplemental services.
Now, does that come out of the site's budget, or does it come out of a set-aside at the district office?
District level. Uh-huh. Any sanction... other than the requirement for a percentage for a professional development site, the sanctions are at the LEA level. It was sort of a change in the philosophy under NCLB that the district must take responsibility for everything going on at all of its schools.
Okay, and would that be part of that 15%, or would there be an additional?
It's
okay.
different, yeah.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Any other questions from the board? No. Thank you so much, Ms. Valentine. Okay, the next, do we need a 5-minute break? Let's take a 5-minute break then, since we don't have all board members present. Okay, and that'll give you time to change your presentation.
PowerPoint replace the one that was in our packet?
Yeah.
Because don't you see it says draft on the one we got? Oh, it doesn't.
This one's good.
You have to know
we're in transition.
On the top here, when you print, it says draft, but so when I forward it,
sometimes I put it on the words.
Well, hers does say draft very, very, very
much. There's not a watermark for PowerPoint that I can figure out.
Oh.
I can do an art that will do it to every slide.
Yeah.
So, and when I print, I can tell it to say draft. So when it prints, it should be my printer.
Oh.
I apologize. That was
you
not.
You know what? I already know. I already made a make little draft stickers for when the update comes out.
Yeah.
It's all going to say draft.
It's all going to say it. Now you're going to have draft over everything.
Now
that you'll
have
just
draft over everything.
I'm just always like, okay, which one am I going to keep?
Well, I figure for the copies that we make for the update, I'll just have the
I just date everything I get.
Yes, I could look at it that way. You have 322 and 327.
After a while, your version gets
I'm not getting on what you're
talking. After a while, every version's like, what did you miss today?
My eyes are starting to close. I'm sorry. I'm a 10 o'clock lady.
Can we table the presentation
until
next time?
The
mechanical. Yeah, I'd prefer. Can we table this one?
Especially since we already discussed this in the past and four members weren't interested.
The middle schools. And like for
In my year of kind of catering volume
hey.
When I go
I was done before the time she got up here.
Okay.
I don't know.
Oh, I have to make up the time. I have my reading glasses on. I'm going to have to read slow.
Wasn't screwing up. They would have had all these people out here. We'd have been done 20 over an hour ago.
Staring me down and cheering loud.
No, I
didn't. You me after it was over.
Don't you remember Will? Yeah, it's about 45 minutes. I'm not over there going.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no.
I got to go get it before. All right.
Yeah. Mine broke.
Thank you.
No,
there, I just can't.
I'm all right.
Well, it looks like it's happening.
At 30 seconds. By the time she got up to there, I was back.
You go in the classrooms, but where's the disconnect?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm a dead man.
I just realized it now.
Okay, we are back in session. Thank you. And we are going to have an informational report on transitional kindergarten.
I know how everyone is so very excited. Good evening.
Good evening.
Transitional kindergarten has been in the news recently. This has led to many conflicting reports, causing confusion amongst many stakeholders. I'm here tonight.
Really?
Yes, I get many phone calls from parents, teachers, office staff.
Just say stakeholders.
Okay.
We understand. We know the term.
All right. I'm here tonight to share the current information and direction we have received from the state. In 2010, SB 1381 became law. It is known as the Kindergarten Readiness Act of 2010. One of the primary features is that it adjusted the entry date of kindergarten by 1 month, beginning in 2013, and ending in 2015, in which all kindergartners will be 5 by September 1st. Additionally, because of this change in the law, it has adjusted the entry date for first graders as well. The law also created a transitional kindergarten program. The law reads, in the 2013 school year, a child who will have his or her fifth birthday between November 1st and December 2nd shall be admitted to a transitional kindergarten program maintained by the district. The district is required by the law to offer this program, although attendance is not compulsory. Transitional kindergarten is a 2-year program in which there is a modified curriculum that is designed to meet the age and developmental needs of this age span. It is to be considered a bridge between preschool and traditional kindergarten. In the recent budget proposal by Governor Brown, transitional kindergarten would not be funded nor mandated. This has led to confusion and uncertainty by many districts. Clarification was recently given stating transitional kindergarten is required by law and it will be funded under the current law. Of course, West Covina will continue to seek clarification as more information becomes available. Just this morning I got a little webinar piece just to give us more updates. We recognize that the law can change, but at this time it is currently on the books as SB 1381. As required by the law, we'll offer at least one transitional kindergarten class. West Cove Primary Center has been chosen because it is a central location. Depending on enrollment, a second location may be needed. Monta Vista has been tentatively identified. This chart that you see is a sampling of local districts' plans for transitional kindergarten. As you can see, there are two districts who are waiting to see if the law changes, and because we did this query of the districts about a week and a half ago, they may have made some decisions in the interim here. And the majority of the surrounding districts are actively planning to implement beginning in the fall. As you can see, there are a variety of programs and designs that are being considered. All districts do plan to locate centrally because of the limited numbers of students that would be in this population. These are the program structure options that we have considered and that we're looking at. There's three of them. First is the half-day model. This model would allow for the first year to focus on readiness, social and behavior skills necessary for kindergarten, while year two would focus on the mastery of kindergarten skills and standards. Moreover, it would be more appropriate for these students to attend school in a half-day setting due to their developmental needs. While a transitional kindergarten teacher would be in the program for a half day, he or she could serve as an intervention teacher for the other portion of the day. This model also allows us to maximize our space by housing up to 2 classrooms per classroom or per room. Concerns for this program would be that it would be a compacted second school year in which the cognitively demand for a traditional kindergarten or for the mastery of standards would be challenging for the students, and it would also not align to the regular school hours of the rest of the school and may cause some scheduling concerns for parents. The progressive model, or a half-day program that would transition to a full-day program, would allow for curriculum to adjust and pace over the time of the 2-year program. This would allow for options of additional enrichment and intervention to provide additional support to students. The design would allow students to mature and adjust to school before the demands of a full-day kindergarten is put upon them. The TK, or transitional K teacher, would provide would be able to provide intervention the portion of the year that they are a half-day program teacher. A concern could be for space, as this would only allow 1 classroom to be assigned per room, as well as parent scheduling concerns.
The last model that is presented before you is a full-day program. This program would be modified as under the required law, but allow for additional enrichment and intervention to supplement the core program. It would align to the school schedule, alleviating parent concerns of split schedules. Concerns would be young students may struggle attending a cognitively demanding schedule for a full day, leading to frustrations and inappropriate behaviors. Another thought is also one of the things is that with a full-day program, we might be really creating some super kindergartners who would be really much more advanced than maybe some of the traditional kindergartners having the program because they've had a two-year full-day program. Not necessarily a concern nor a pro or a con, but it's something that I did think of. And that, once again, concern be about space for both the previous model as this model, as over the next 3 years, the program would expand. And currently in our elementary schools, we are fortunately quite full. Cost, we have curriculum, materials, furniture, busing, possibly as required by our BERT policy, and staffing. The transitional kindergarten class will be funded on a per-pupil ADA model formula. This funding is the same funding for the students in grades K through 12. This is a generally funded program. The students in this transitional K program would also receive the same categorical fundings as the students that are on that same campus. although, based on funding models, there are certain age restrictions which they may not generate the funds. So that is a basic overview of what the current law is right now and program option models that you may wish to consider.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Spence, do you have any questions?
I only had one on how we would address the issue of identifying special ed children.
It would be the same model that we do now.
We would have them in the same class, or would we try to figure out some kind of pre-K program that we could place them in? We have more kids, though, that we'll be dealing with, then. Right?
Well, currently, I mean, these are the students right now that we have.
That's
this is the age span, correct.
It's a different curriculum, yeah.
Correct. So if the students come in and we note that there's a concern, we'd be obligated under that child fine to determine if there's a special need. Depending on what the testing determines would depend on the placement of the student.
Yeah, does the curriculum, I guess I haven't seen it, but does it deal with some of the gender differences? because dealing with children at that age.
The curriculum would go through a curriculum adoption, and we'd be bringing that to you for adoption as a formal process. In looking at some of the curriculum that has come through, I can't say it directly deals with gender differences, but it does talk about things that would be that social, emotional, appropriate behaviors.
But there are different gender differences at that age especially. Well, I mean, all ages, but at that age, there are gender differences in development.
Correct, and I do believe aspects of that is addressed of because of the type of program, there's many more models of centers and activities that students do that allow them to explore and have that enrichment in those areas. So if a student was more apt to be in that hands-on physical, there are areas that would be designed in the room for that. If there's someone that's much more of a book and likes to read, there'd be areas for that. So.
Yeah, all those four-year-old readers.
But.
Ms. Poulos.
What if there's more students interested in coming than we had classrooms available? Because it looks like most people are doing two classes. What if there are more students interested than, or if there are more than 40 students interested in coming?
I would turn back. We find space. There are students.
Edgewood's empty.
We're not confined to the 20 to 1 with the preschool, so we decide the number of kids in the classroom. We have more options regarding that. Because of that 1 month, we're not anticipating it would be a large amount, but again, we don't know the answers to that. Mm-hmm.
And so anybody who was interested would actually be able to come in. There wouldn't be a waiting list, and we wouldn't prioritize.
No.
Compared to needs, anybody who's interested could come.
Any students in that birth date range would be given the same consideration.
Okay, and then the busing, if we only have it at West Cove, is everyone outside of that catchment area going to be bused from their home school to West Cove?
We would have to look at policy and get more direction from the state. There is some conflicting information about whether busing or not would be actually required.
Those were my only two questions.
Ms. Shoemaker. Mr. Cox.
Is there a term, redshirting kindergartners? Is that a term? I'm serious. It's
not a term, but I know what you're saying. It's this came out of a bill from Simidian, who they were concerned that because these are the youngest students would be given the opportunity to have that extra growth of year, but not necessarily in a preschool.
But I'm talking about the one that decides, you know what, I'm going to start kindergarten at 6 instead of that. And because somebody, it seems like they'd said, no, if that's what you're going to do, no, you come show up at our door with a 6-year-old kindergartner, we're going to put them in first grade?
By law, kindergarten is not compulsory. If a student arrives at 6 years old, we would place them in first grade unless the parent said, I've personally retained my child and I'm requesting them to be in kindergarten.
So they still would have that?
They do have that option, absolutely.
Do you have, as you look at the three options, because we're really struggling with that, half-day versus full-day, do you have any thoughts about that?
That was what my comment was going to be on, and then we can go around the board. For the progressive half to full, let me make sure I'm understanding. In this progressive half to full, the kids would stay with the same teacher for 2 years, or could we have a preschool, they stick in that half-day program, and then the following year we can now move them into our regular kindergarten classes.
I want to clarify, and this is something in the law, this is not a preschool program.
Right. It's a kindergarten.
Between.
Right.
So it is a two-year mm-hmm. kindergarten program.
Right.
Thus, the curriculum has to be modified for a two-year span so that when the parents enroll the students, they are understanding that it is a two-year program they are enrolling for.
Okay.
As I said, it's not required. They could choose not to enroll their student, and they could come the following year and place them in a traditional kindergarten program.
Okay, so the parents know, and it's going to be made very clear that their child will be in that classroom for 2 years.
They're in the program for
2 years.
Correct.
Okay. So
whether a teacher loops or how that
right.
other things.
I'm thinking more about the student who other students who would then look at that student as different. You kids are different, just like a kid who's retained. You're different. Everybody knows.
That would be a consideration a parent would have to look out if they to determine whether or not they would choose to enroll their child.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Your preference, Mr. Spence? We'll go this way.
Well, I don't know. You know, we're thinking we don't have any money, so you know, I'm not sure the state, when they approve the budget, just won't waive, you know, us being have to do this. I can see it easily put it in that kind of language. And they say $700 million, you know, or something like that, by moving up the dates and stuff. But my question, I guess, would be, is there a way to offer both, half day and full day? So that parents can figure out, because the goal of this is, you know, the kids know, the parents know, you know, what works best, in theory. And so is there a way to offer both? And then depending on what the parents and the enrollment looks like, since we're talking about fantasy money to begin with, you know, then we decide, you know, that we have enough for, you know, full day and one half day, or look, only two people signed up for the half day, so we're not going to be able to do that. Is there a way to do that?
Well, the funding's the ADA formula, which means the class would generate, whether it's a half day or full day, the same dollars.
So you say do half day? No, but I'm just saying that, you know, I'm
But I think there's some, I think there's some
no,
laws
was
about
funding.
The program would have to be the same program we offer at a school.
I think that's one of the difficult pieces. A law states one thing, the budget, and that's correct.
Correct.
We've watched many things to try to clarify.
We get updates almost every day about the funding.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. it is an unfunded mandate. I mean,
currently it is a funded mandate as written in the law. The budget has not been approved, nor any of those pieces of it. So at this time, it is a funded mandate, and it's based on the ADA formula.
Mandate with no money.
No, with money. It is funded on the regular ADA.
The governor's taking it out of the budget.
But as the law stands today, according to the school services that it is as of today. I'm not saying tomorrow or when a budget's approved, yeah, as well, of the this moment.
Well, isn't there a way today we can find out, like, who would enroll and what their options would they think, you know, would best serve their children?
We have 7 students currently that parents have picked up packets.
And what do the 7 want to do? They said half day, full day, which one would they want?
We did not survey them because we were bringing to the board.
Because to me, if the goal is parents are deciding, you know, some of this, then let's let them figure it out.
I mean, I think the issues for us is space. It's space. It's, you know, at the end of what the second year of kindergarten would look like. There's just so many things that we're struggling with. We don't have a recommendation for you right now. We wanted to share this with you and see if you had any strong feelings one way or the other, but we don't have a strong recommendation at this point.
Well, if we're disaggregating the data, then no matter if we have super kindergartners, then we'll be ready for them in first grade because we're disaggregating it for all of the students. So I know that's dreamland, but... Well, in reality, that we would want them to be as prepared as possible,
absolutely.
And if they were super first graders, we'd be
thrilled.
Super excited.
Mm-hmm.
I know one of the reasons we went to full day kindergarten was because the parents were leaving our district and going to districts where there was full day kindergarten because they were using it as daycare. If we had a half day program, would these students be eligible for YASIS? Because I know there's not a cost to YASIS.
That's another piece that we'd have to look at because of how that grant is written. This law came in after the grant and the program model that was written of the kids and the age and things that we serve. I don't have that answer and have to be. It's a good question. It just would have to be investigated.
Because I think that would make a difference in which way I was going. I really don't think developmentally they're ready for a full day, and that the progression half day to full day would be the best choice for students. But if we're going to, they were saying if we lose the children in kindergarten, we don't get them back. So I don't want to lose them in that span because we're not offering a full day. But if we could supplement it with YASIS, which I went and visited some of those programs during the open houses, and they were doing some phenomenal things after school, that would be a way to keep those parents in if they wanted it. I mean, they would have that option. They wouldn't have to sign up for YASIS, and they could have the half day. But if they needed it for child care, they could go to YASIS for free.
I like that model with the YASIS. I agree in terms of kindergarten readiness. I like the half day to the full. I think that works, especially with the little ones. Holy cow. So, but that's true. I don't want to lose students because of child care issues. So if we could get YASIS, then let's do progressive to full. If we can't, then we're going to have to go full day. And right now we're a district of choice, so students can come and they're going to, we're already getting, you know, people miss the deadline, so they're already telling me they're going to submit their applications.
There's a group of people out there, though, that want half day and they can't find it around, too.
Well, the city.
That's why, you know, let's offer a choice at the beginning and kind of see what happens.
The city has a very.
Vote with their feet.
The city has a very low fee. Half day preschool that is a half model.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but I mean, there's some people that might want the half day, and you know, even people in these districts where they're all doing full day, you know, they won't have people that want to do it. Maybe, you know, I mean, so I just think we should, you know, look and let people decide with their feet what they want to sign up for.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Poulos, and then
about the half day. I believe some of our kindergarten teachers would work with the parents when they didn't feel the children were developmentally ready. I know it happened at Vine. It might have happened at San Jose Edison. Dr. Patton may have shared it. But there were 3 principals who shared it. But they might have had 1 or 2 students that only stayed for the morning and because they weren't quite ready to stay the whole day. So it's not either or. It sounds like some of the principals were given that option where they didn't have to stay the whole day, at least at the beginning.
I would have to look into that. I'm not aware of
And I don't know if they had a 504 plan that allowed it.
It may have been a specific accommodation for a specific student.
Right. And that I couldn't tell you.
Ms. Shoemaker, your opinion?
The South Hills Academy does half day or full day depending on what the student wants for pre-K. So you may want to talk to them about how the model works for them and how they divide the class up. I think it would be good to give the parents the option. If their child is ready to be there a full day, they can stay a full day. Otherwise, we've tailored the program so the student doesn't have to be there the full day and can leave at half day, either come in the afternoon or come in the morning. I mean, we're sort of flying blind with this, so we might as well try as many options as we can.
Mr. Cox, your preference.
I've been touring open houses with a relative expert in this area on a personal site, and so it's been rather interesting listening to all of this sort of stuff, especially since I've got a grandson who's, I can't remember whether it's December 3rd or December 2nd. He's right there on that cusp, and anyway, this is a lot of fun, and to talk to the kindergarten teachers about, you know, their excitement about the opportunities to do this and what it affords for the development of the kids, and moms who say, extra daycare, score. But I don't know, it seems awfully long for me for a full day, for a 5-year-old full day. But again, I don't disagree with this option, educational opportunities that we afford, and that's what I'd like to see us do. But I think that effectively, my gut tells me this half transition period of time is going to be rough. I mean, I've been to kindergarten classrooms. I think you and I went to a kindergarten classroom one time, and to see these little kids just bawling their eyes out as mom and as they're ripping the kids from the moms and that sort of stuff. It's tough. And so, anyway, yeah. Good luck.
Thanks. The past kindergarten teacher, I can tell you, it's a lot
and a
to consider.
Good one too. And a really
thank
good
you.
One.
You've seen me do some things, yes.
It was amazing.
It's a lot to consider.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. We're in good
do you
hands.
Have the information you need?
Yes.
You pulled,
I believe
we pulled
we
the board.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Taylor, for the presentation. We are going to go ahead and. Does anyone have any Board of Education discussion? Okay. Dates to remember. I do want to call your attention to March 29th, San Jose Charter Open House. On our grid, it was listed at 6 o'clock, and here it's correct at 5. I just wanted to make sure everybody was aware it's 5 so that you don't show up and expect that it's starting at 6. Correct. Exactly. It's over. It's from 5 to 7. So I wanted to draw your attention to that. Okay, then we will go ahead, seeing no discussion, call this meeting adjourned at 10:10.